Aguna. And let me emphasize the word Aguna simply means a stranded woman, an abandoned woman. And it has actually three possible applications in modern life. The classical Aguna was simply a woman whose husband disappeared, either missing in action, he simply ran away, we don't know where he is. Victims of the Holocaust, victims of the World Trade Center, people who were taken prisoners of war, these are problems because unlike secular law that basically says that if somebody has an unexplained absence for 7 years, they could be legally presumed to be dead, halacha does not have a presumption of death by absence. And if a woman was a married woman, even if the husband is gone for 25 years, we don't hear anything about it, generally speaking, she's going to be forbidden. She has becheskes eishes ish. In fact, the Gemara says, even if the husband is fairly old, he was 60 years old and disappeared for 20 years, there are going to be all sorts of shilas. So we'll call that Aguna type 1. That's not really going to be the subject of my talk, other than to say that in Aguna type 1, Chazal greatly relaxed the rules of evidence to establish death of the husband. So, for example, the Mishnah in Yevamos says we can rely on one witness. We can rely on different types of circumstantial evidence. You don't need two kosher eyewitnesses. You can rely on another woman. You can rely on a katan. Even the woman herself who says, I know my husband's dead. If she actually claims to have seen that, she would be believed. So, dental records, DNA, circumstantial evidence, all of these things are utilized and they're still utilized in cases of missing in action and the like. That's an Aguna type 1 where there is not going to be any get simply because we don't know if the husband is dead or alive. Now, Aguna type 2 is the one that where we know where the husband is, we know who the husband is. But the husband simply decides he is not going to give his wife a get, even if, for example, she has received a civil divorce. Of course, in the state of Israel, there is no such thing as a civil divorce, but let's take the United States or other countries where there is a civil divorce. So even if the woman legally can marry, which she could not do in Israel without a get, but without a get, she is still an eishes ish. And unfortunately, generally speaking, cannot give a woman a get. Beis Din can order a man to give a get, but ultimately the man has to give the get. If the man refuses, the woman is an aguna. And although people often exaggerate how many agunot are there worldwide, people sometimes give you numbers, there are thousands and thousands of women that are languishing as agunot. Well, in some ways, as you'll see, it all depends how you define your terms. A woman is not an aguna because she told her husband on Monday, I want to get divorced, and he didn't give her a get by Tuesday. An aguna is a woman who has gone to Beis Din, and I'll discuss the process. Beis Din has determined that the husband is halachically obligated to give a get, and if the husband refuses, only at that point is she an aguna. So there aren't that many agunot. However, the fact that numerically it's a small number does not change the fact that for the small number of women that are suffering, the suffering is very, very intense. There are agunot that have been waiting for a get for 10 years, 20 years, even longer. There are agunot whose husbands literally have died eventually of old age, leaving the woman, a very elderly woman whose prospects of marriage and having children are now destroyed because of it. So I do want to make two very preliminary points. One is the number of true agunot is not a large number, and one has to be careful not to exaggerate numbers. But the pain of the agunot is very, very significant pain. Now, one needs to understand as well that why do husbands withhold gittin? Why do people do it? The answer is there's not a single reason. Occasionally, there is a husband who genuinely wants reconciliation, and he just wants to come together again. That's rare, but that does happen. Sometimes, it is a bargaining chip, in which the husband basically says, give me $100,000, give me the house, give me exclusive, custody of the children, I'll give you a get. The get is being used as a bargaining chip. And sometimes, it's not even a bargaining chip. It is simply malice, the desire to inflict pain, the desire to hurt, meaning even if you give him, you know, anything he would possibly want, he doesn't want to give the gift. So it ranges from people who want to reconcile, which is the smallest category, to people who are simply sadistic. And how you deal with it is very interesting in terms of the psychology of it. Sometimes, you know, there's an organization in the United States, actually the head of the organization now lives in Ramat Beit Shemesh. This is the organization called ORA. Now, ORA is an acronym, Organization for the Resolution of Agunot. And they do all sorts of things. Their posek is Rav Hershel Schechter, a great Talmud Chacham. They have Facebook rallies, and they have demonstrations, and they have a public humiliation thing. There was a well-known Aguna case in my neck of the woods, my former neck of the woods in Silver Spring. And they were constantly having demonstrations in front of his place of employment, which happened to be the United States Congress and the like. But I will tell you this. I will tell you that psychologically, although I'm not going to talk a lot about psychology per se, I want to talk about the halakhic and legal responses. Sometimes, depending on the case, humiliation is not the best way to get a get from a recalcitrant husband. Because when people feel humiliated and debased, that often makes them dig in their heels. Because they need to convince themselves or the world in some crazy way that they're right. Because if they would give in as a result of humiliation, that would be admitting that they're wrong. So sometimes, and I can tell you that I myself have had some experience with this, sometimes you got to go to the husband, and you kind of have to, even if you're going to lie a little bit, you have to tell the husband, I know your wife is really, you know, not a good person. I know that, but you're a better person. You can be the noble person. You can be the good person. You can be the generous person. You can be the righteous person. You might be talking to a bum, but nevertheless, if you build up a person in that way, often they will be willing to, as long as somebody hears them, somebody hears their pain, because there is pain. Even the recalcitrant husband is acting, he might be acting out of spite, but the spite in turn comes from a sense of pain. And when that pain is addressed, you can sometimes be very, very successful in getting a get. Not in all cases. As I say, sometimes the humiliation aspect backfires and makes people more recalcitrant. Okay. Now, let me explain something about the halakhic process here. In a pure halakhic society that was totally run by halakha, the problem of aguna would be much less pronounced. Because what would happen is this. A woman would go to a beis din, and she would request that the husband give her a get, and the beis din would determine if there are grounds or if there are not grounds. We'll talk about what those grounds are. If the beis din determines that there are grounds for the granting of a get, the beis din will order the husband to give a get. Now, in a pure halakhic society, if a husband refuses to give a get after being ordered by the beis din to give a get, the husband may be beaten until he says, I'm willing. And if he doesn't say, I'm willing, we beat him until he dies, which is another way that she gets her freedom. So in a pure halakhic society, the psak of a beis din may be enforced by any degree of physical coercion, up to and including death. Now, what happens today? Today a woman still goes to beis din. So here we have to sharply differentiate the state of Israel from every other country in the world. Now I'll compare it with the United States, that's the one that I'm more familiar with. In the United States, a woman also is supposed to go to a beis din. And if the beis din orders the husband to give a get, and the husband does not, the question is, what can a beis din do? A beis din in the United States does not have enforcement powers. So the beis din could put the person in cheirim, excommunicate. The beis din could put an ad in the Jewish press, how bad the guy is. But particularly in the United States, where there's a multiplicity of shuls, so this shul doesn't like you, go to another shul, or in some cases the husband might not be religious or doesn't care at all, there's really very little, you know, what did they say? I believe it was a famous remark, Mussolini or Hitler, I don't remember, something about the Pope issued some statement too little too late about fascist aggression. So I think Mussolini said, well, the Pope made his statement, let him back it up with his army. And basically it's the same thing. A beis din in the United States issues pronouncements, How do you back it up? How do you enforce it? There is no enforceability of a psak beis din in the United States unless certain other steps are taken. So the beis din does exist in the United States, but the psak beis din has no legal enforceability, nor can it have legal enforceability because of the separation of church and state. There's no possible way that generally a secular court will order you to listen to a beis din, just like it won't order you to keep Shabbos or put on tefillin. Now, Eretz Yisrael, in Baruch Hashem, is very different in a fundamental way. Although, obviously, we live in a society in which religious-secular tensions are very, very divisive, and there are issues of civil marriage that people are trying to propose. But, as you know, the Beit Din Rabbani is part of the legal system of the state. And as a result, a psak of a Beit Din that a husband is obligated to give a get is a legal judgment of the courts of the state of Israel. And because it is a legal judgment of the courts of the state of Israel, it can be enforced by fines, even by imprisonment. Man can go to jail for failure to give a get to his wife if the Beis Din ordered him to give a get. There are various rules that a passport can be forfeited. A person might lose his driver's license. In fact, a few years ago, the State Department issued a travel advisory. I don't know why they're Misayeya Lidvaravera, warning men going from the United States to Israel. Any man that was ordered by an Israeli court to give a get to his wife should be warned that if they go to Israel, they may have their passport confiscated. There's actually a travel advisory, don't go to Israel. Kind of crazy for that particular reason. So, Lemaisa, in the state of Israel, agunot do have remedies that are not available in the United States because this is a judgment of the courts of the state of Israel. But even in Eretz Yisrael, there is a significant problem of agunot for the following reason. Reason number one is it is not so easy for a woman to get an order of a beis din requiring the man to give get. And I'll talk about that. Which means to say, all of these remedies only kick in when the beis din has said that there is a chiyuv and an obligation to give a get. And often that threshold is not going to be passed. I'll talk about that why. And that's very significant. And that depends on, although statistics are not necessarily dispositive, but for example, in the Yerushalayim district, only around 5% of petitions of tikkun that are opened by women culminate in an order to give a get. Other parts of the country, the percentage is higher. Now, whether that's connected to the composition of the judges, or the merit of the claims, which of course is what we hope it would be, or whether it's based on Tel Aviv, you know, marriages are more broken and therefore there's more of a justification, I don't know. But I do want to say that in Eretz Yisrael, it is not at all easy as a halachic and practical matter to get that order. That is one reason why a woman might be an aguna. On the other hand, one might argue, if the Beis Din did not determine there were halachic grounds for a get, then definitionally she's not getting aguna because she hasn't established the halachic case. But reason number two is, even if a woman gets such an order, even if the Beis Din paskins, you are mechuyev to give a get. Some of these sanctions don't work. The malicious nature of people who don't want to do this are so strong that some of them are willing to languish in prison for years and years and years. And although in a purely halachic society we could move to flogging and beating and even killing, the Knesset has not authorized that. The Knesset's maximum penalty is essentially imprisonment, incarceration. And that does happen. But some people are willing to stay in prison. In fact, Time magazine had an article around 15 years ago, I remember, I'm sure there may have been other cases, in which somebody remained in prison for 30 years in order not to give a get to his wife. And a third reason is, a lot of the aguna cases involve people who are already incarcerated criminals. They're already in jail. So what's going to be your pressure? There really is no pressure. Now, Rav Oldenburg, the great Sitzeliezer, one of the great Dayanim in Eretz Yisrael, he actually wanted the Knesset to consider flogging or beating as an alternative remedy for incarcerated husbands who don't give a guess, but that the Knesset was not receptive to that particular proposal. So the aguna problem is a greater problem in the United States than it is in Eretz Israel, but because Eretz Israel, there are opportunities that women have that they would not have in the United States, but nevertheless, for the reasons I mentioned, there are, unfortunately, l'tzareinu, there are agunot in Eretz Israel as well. Now, one other additional thing. I had mentioned that in a halachic society, once the Beit Din orders a man to give a get, that order may be enforced by any type of physical pressure, by fines, by beating, ad shetetzei nafsho. Now, you may have read that there's presently a federal prosecution in the United States of a group of rabbis who hired for a fee, for a fairly large fee, would hire goons to beat people up in order to get a get. Let me point out the following. Without expressing my opinion on that particular, because there is an issue of Chilul Hashem, meaning even if, halachically, once there's a psak based in, you can beat somebody with a lead pipe, and that is mutter, once there's a psak based in. But whether that is a proper thing to do when we live among the Gentiles is a very difficult question. But I do want to point out the following. The heter to use physical force and coercion is only when the get has been ordered by a beis din. If a woman were to simply hire the same goons to beat up a husband without going to a beis din, without having a psak beis din, you have to know, not only is that forbidden, but the get would be an invalid get. This is a very important rule. Because we start off with the following proposition that seems to be contradictory. Any get that is obtained by duress and compulsion is pusul. This is called a get mu'usa. A get mu'usa is pusul. It's a pusul get. A get has to be given willingly. So the question becomes very obvious. So how come if a beis din orders a man to give a get, we beat him until he gives the get? So the Gemara says, well, we beat him until he says, I want to give the get. He has to say I want, but if he doesn't say I want, I beat him. So the Rambam asks the obvious question. What type of fiction is that? You're telling me on one hand, it's like matter and antimatter coexisting. You're telling me on one hand, a get has to be given willingly, without duress, without compulsion, and you're then telling me, but I can beat him on the head until he says I want to get. So the Rambam offers a very profound psychological explanation. The Rambam says, in the panemius of the neshama of every Jew, they want to keep the halacha, they want to keep the Torah. But the Yetzer Hara sometimes makes it creates false attractions. So if a beis din ordered a man to give a get, his true self wants to give the get. Elamai. But the Yetzer Hara of money, of anger, of rage, prevents his true will from working. So when I put a gun to his head and I say, give the get or I shoot, that takes away the Yetzer Hara not to give the get. And what emerges is the true unfettered will, what the person really wants to do. But the point is, that's only true if the beis din determined al pi din, he has to give a get. If a woman uses the same goons without that psak beis din, the same get that would be valid with the psak beis din now becomes a get mu'usa without. So people have to know that even if you could get away with it, simply hiring people to beat up a guy is not going to be machzir the get unless there's a psak beis din. So now, let's step back.
Any people that don't accept the force decree that he has to give a get, and then you can use...
yes, then you can use force, yes.
They consider it still get mu'usa, even if the beis din...
No. I'm sorry if it wasn't clear. Once the beis din ordered him to give a get, even if they didn't order force, anybody could take the law into their hands.
But there are many in Haredim, for example, who don't accept some beis din...
They don't accept it.
And they say any beating will be to get moves.
Well, that's going to be particularly in Eretz Yisrael, that's going to be an interdenominational problem of Haredim accepting this based and that based and the like. That may be a problem. And you'll see that a lot. You will see that sometimes a Rabbanut court based in ordered a get and it was obtained, and there'll be signs up that say get Mu'usa. Okay, but al pi din, I mean, we have to talk to Gedolei HaPoskim, but generally speaking, if it's a kosher Beis Din, it doesn't make a difference if it's Dati Leumi or Zionist or Haredi or anything else. A kosher Beis Din is a kosher Beis Din. But then, of course, you get into people saying, this isn't a kosher Beis Din. So that's Ein L'davar Sof on those types of problems, unfortunately. Now, so you understand that everything starts with a woman getting an order that her husband must give a get. So now, what are the grounds for that? A woman goes to Beis Din. A woman doesn't want to be married. A woman files a petition, opens a tick. Beis Din has to determine, is the husband chayav to give a get, or, you know, do we simply say, try to reconcile, or we might advise a man to give a get, but we don't use the magic words, you know, chayav or kofin lagarish. So here there's a very big machlokas, and we just learned this in Daf Yomi Mamish just a half an hour ago. That is, the Shitas HaRambam is quite extraordinary. The Rambam Shita is, if a woman goes to Beis Din and all she says is Ma'is Alai, which literally means he is disgusting to me, which means essentially she says, I don't want to be married anymore. She doesn't give a reason, she doesn't give a basis, she just makes that declaration. According to the Rambam, the Beis Din will order the man to give a get. And the Rambam's language, which sounds very modern, is a woman is not a shevuya, she is not a captive maid, to be forced to cohabit with a man that she cannot stand. So according to the Rambam, it would be extraordinarily easy for a woman. Essentially, this is the equivalent of, in the United States, irreconcilable differences. You don't have to give any reason, irreconcilable differences. And so according to that, virtually 100% of the time a woman wants a get, the Beis Din would order it. But here is the problem. Rabbeinu Tam is cholek on the Beis Din. Rabbeinu Tam says it is inconceivable that with a taina of Moes Olai, the Beis Din will order a man to give a get, because Shema Einaha Nasna Biacher, maybe this is just an excuse because she is attracted to another man. Now, both the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah paskin like Rabbeinu Tam that Moyes Olai does not give the woman a right to a get. Now, this is very critical, and this is very unusual. Any student of Halacha knows that at least the Mechaber of Yosef Karo, that 95% of his Pesukim are based on the Rambam. And the reason is because Rav Yosef Karo adopted a halachic formula for the resolution of disputes, in which he identified three great preeminent authorities and goes with a 2 out of 3 approach. And his three preeminent authorities are the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. 2 out of 3, he paskins. Problem is, Rav Yosef Karo stacked the deck because the Rambam is almost totally based on the Rif. So essentially, the Rush is always the odd man out, which is why the Ramah wrote the Ashkenazic glosses on the Shulchan Aruch that incorporates the Rush and the Balei HaTosfos. So it's extraordinarily rare for Rav Yosef Karo, at least, and Sfardim follow Rav Yosef Karo, to reject the view of the Rambam in favor of a view of Rabbeinu Tam. But one of the few cases where it's done is, unfortunately, perhaps, exactly this case of Gittin, in which the Taina of Moes Alai does not entitle a woman to a get. And I know Rav Shlomo Riskin, the Rav of Efrat, wrote a book around 20 years ago. I think it was his doctoral dissertation for NYU. And he essentially made a long case that we ought to go back to the Rambam. But practically, I have to say, this cannot happen. I mean, when you're dealing with Shulchan Aruch, Ramah, and all of the Nosei Kalim of the Shulchan Aruch who do not follow the view of the Rambam, one cannot turn back the clock. Just like, you know, I can't go back and say, oh, I want to go like Beis Shammai instead of Beis Hillel. I mean, certain matters get resolved. They were machloksim, but at this point, the matter is resolved. However, I do want to point out that this is where one needs to understand this. So even though we don't paskin like the Rambam, that Moyes Olai is enough of a basis to get a get, to receive a get, the Tshuva Sarash, who follows Rabbeinu Tam, says that if a woman can give substantiation and basis for why she finds this marriage repulsive, then she will be entitled to a get. And the basis would be certainly physical abuse, extreme emotional abuse, non-financial support, etc., and various other types of behaviors. Now, this is where the but they didn't differ in how they assess this, because often physical abuse might be, unfortunately, something that's relatively easier to establish. Could it be bruises and the like? Emotional abuse is a very, very tricky issue. There is a phenomenon of extreme emotional abuse, but there's a whole range here. I mean, the fact that he yelled at me last Monday at dinner, or you know, he didn't thank me for supper. You know, so one person's severe emotional abuse might just be routine, you know, complaining and the like. So this is where the but they didn't have difficulty. And this is where, I hate to say this, because halacha should not depend on who are your dayanim and which basin you go to. But particularly in this area it does, because in assessing whether a given relationship or a given set of behaviors is abusive and exploitive, that often depends on the milieu and the background from which you're going. So I do know that some organizations like the National Conference of Young Israel Rabbis, they're trying to integrate Dayanim into certain type of psychological training and sociological training, and understanding family dynamics, and understanding that the expectations of what is tolerable in a relationship may vary with time and place. And again, Chas Hashem, this may sound like reform rhetoric, God forbid, but one has to understand that in the context of what is called abusive behavior, there is indeed something that is toloi and zman and makom, and dayanim are being trained and are being sensitized in this issue. But here's the point, therefore. The point basically is, according to the Rambam, the grounds for a woman getting a get order is very, very simple. Moyes alai. We paskin like Rabbeinu Tam. Moyes alai is lo maspik. But if it's moyes alai with what is called an amasla is some type of substantiation to show that the relationship is not tolerable, even like Rabbeinu Tam, there would be a basis for a get order. Once a woman gets her get order, in Eretz Yisrael we have incarceration, we have fines, we have a passport revocation, we have driver's license suspension, we do not have beating, although halakha would allow that. In the United States, you don't have any of that unless you do it under the table because of the separation of church and state. So as a result, when you survey all of this, in other words, this would be the standard way of just going to the Beis Din, the problems are twofold. Getting the order, and second, enforcing the order once you get it. These are the two sets of problems that need to be considered. Now, let me point out that in the vocabulary of Beis Din, there are many, many different types of lashonos that one has to be very careful. The standard of chayav lagaresh, or yotzi, or kofin lagaresh, that refers to a get order that is actually enforced by all of these sanctions. But often, a Beis Din might be unwilling to make such a finding, but they may issue a recommendation. It is proper for the parties to terminate the marriage. Well, unfortunately, that doesn't do a lot, meaning if the person has Yiras Shamayim, he'll take that suggestion. But unless they use the exact words of Chayav or Kofin or Yotzi, all it is a recommendation, the same recommendation you would get from your local synagogue rabbi, etc., and that cannot be backed up by any sanctions whatsoever. So because of this, poskim have looked at other avenues that could help a woman who finds herself in a very, very difficult situation. So let me go over a few avenues. And one of the avenues was very, very recent, just a year ago, Tainus Esther in Tzfat, a very, very controversial decision. One avenue that has been used is that sometimes we might be able to extricate agunot by showing that their initial marriage was no good. And in fact, we often do this not so much for agunah problems, but we do it for mamzer problems. And this is based on the psukim of Rav Moshe Feinstein. We know that what is a mamzer? A mamzer is not an out-of-wedlock child. An out-of-wedlock child, according to halacha, has no disabilities at all. But a mamzer is a child that is born from adultery when a woman marries another man or lives with another man and has not gotten a get from her first husband, right? That is a mamzer. And a mamzer is a Jew, of course. A mamzer is a full-fledged Jew. But a Mamzer has very severe marital disabilities. A Mamzer cannot marry other Jews other than other Mamzerim, or a Mamzer could marry a Gioris, and if he marries a Gioris, the kid is still going to be a Mamzer and the like. So if a woman marries without a get, Chas v'shalom, the child that is born afterwards might be a Mamzer. So, just to give you an example, in any yeshiva that deals with a lot of Balei Tshuva, like Or Sameach, Esha Torah, so we often have guys who are 25 and 30, who are products of second marriages. Their mothers may have gotten divorced 50 years ago, and then married another guy, and they were born, 30 years ago, and they were born from that second marriage. And this was not an Aguda case. This was not a case of the first husband refused to give a get. They weren't religious. They didn't bother to get a get. They didn't even know about it. So Chas v'shalom. So the kid learns, he's learning Chumash for the first time, and he reads about a Mamzer and asks his Rebbe, what's a Mamzer? And we say what a Mamzer is, and am I a Mamzer? Right? We get the story all the time. And the Hadracha that we have from Moshe Feinstein is quite logical, although it's not without controversy. And that is, a child is a Mamzer if they were born from a second relationship where the first relationship didn't have a get. But that's only going to be true if the first relationship was halachically valid marriage. Only a halachically valid marriage needs a get. And if it's not a halachically valid marriage, you don't need a get in the first place. And we discover that many of these first marriages, you didn't have kosher witnesses, etc. They weren't Shomer Shabbos, or they were women, or they were related, etc. So by invalidating the first marriage, and again, one needs to go to a chashuv posek to do this. One cannot do this on their own. One should not be cavalier, God forbid, because there's an issue of Eishes Ish. But by showing that the first marriage is invalid, you don't need a get. If you don't need a get, mela, the second marriage will not produce mamzerim. People ask the kasha, but if you're invalidating the first marriage because you didn't have kosher witnesses, then aren't you invalidating the second marriage, which also didn't have kosher witnesses, so aren't you making him a mamzer? Big mistake. No. All you're making him is an out-of-wedlock kid. Out-of-wedlock kid is not a mamzer. Right? That's very important. There was a letter in the New York Times around 25 years ago, where a girl complained. She wrote to the New York Times and she said she was the product of her first marriage. Her half-sister was born from the same mother from the second marriage, and the half-sister became an Orthodox Balas Tshuva, and she went to Israel, and the state of Israel said she was not a mamzer because they invalidated the first marriage. So the sister says, this is another example of how Israel only cares about the Orthodox because they made me a mamzer in order that my sister shouldn't be a mamzer. They just did by making me a mamzer because I'm not Orthodox, so they don't care about me. Now this was actually published in the New York Times with no response. The obvious either mistake or intentional distortion is that sister number one was most assuredly not made a mamzer. It was just an out of wedlock situation. So now I do want to point out that Rav Moshe's psak, Rav Moshe's psak is not without controversy. For example, there are poskim that actually say that even if the initial marriage ceremony was invalid, if husband and wife continued to cohabit over time and their relationship was known to some religious Jews, those religious Jews become witnesses to what you might call a common law halachic marriage. And therefore, l'chatchila, we advise women, even if they were civilly married or reform marriage, l'chatchila, we do advise them to get a get, because of the possibility that the invalid marriage may be turned into a valid marriage by cohabitation. But that's because if we can get a get, we try. But in terms of a child that was born, in which if he's a mamzer, there's no takana, so Lamaisa, even Rebbe Yashiv, who was very strict on this, Rebbe Yashiv said we can follow Rav Moshe's view that the child is not a mamzer. So now, this could work with some aguna cases as well, that if the first marriage was not halachically valid and the husband disappeared, perhaps we could be samech on this, although as I say, what we do for a mamzer is not necessarily the same as what we do for the woman, in which you might encourage her to get a get. I remember myself, I was involved in a case, and this is quite extraordinary. This was the one time I got to ask a shaila to Rebbe Yashiv, But of course, you're only given 1 minute, and then and no follow-up questions. I'm going to put you out. But this involved again a situation where we needed to ascertain whether a marriage that occurred in 1950 was a halachically valid marriage. That's how far back it had to be. And lo and behold, this was a marriage in the Boston area, and the rabbi of that kehillah happened to be living with his daughter in Silver Spring, Maryland, in retirement. And he didn't know anything about the wedding, but we were told that the wedding had the Orthodox chazan of his show was the Masada Kedushin. And the rabbi said the following. He says, this chazan never used Shomer Shabbos witnesses because nobody in the show talked to him. And therefore, he only used non-Shomer Shabbos witnesses. Now, he didn't know anything about this wedding. He just gave a general statement. So we take the whole thing. I went to Rebbe Yashiv and says, is this enough to declare the first marriage invalid? And Rebbe Yashiv says, if it's a shayla of mamzeris, you could be samichan. So ad kedei kach, he was willing to be megal. Of course, he got so many of the shaylas. This looked like, I thought this was such an unusual shayla. It looked like this was the 100th time he got asked that day. So anyway, okay. But to do what?
Using non-valid witnesses, for example.
There is. That proposal has been made. In effect, we should only use puzzle witnesses for Kiddushin. But, the proposal has been made quite seriously. But the problem with that is that it's kind of like killing a mosquito with an atom bomb. Meaning like this. Aguna is a big, big tragedy. But the solution to Aguna would not mean, let's destroy marriage. Let's destroy Kiddushin. I mean, Baruch Hashem, the overwhelming majority of marriages... well, not the overwhelming majority, unfortunately, but at least the majority of marriages, even if the bare majority, are going to be good marriages, and we don't want to get rid of Kiddushin.
The rabbi that proposed it said that kibbutz, for example, did a survey that 60-70% clears, and therefore the kibbutz mission.
There is such a cheshbon to deliberately make it the puzzle. That is correct. Yeah.
Which goes to the point of allowing civil marriage.
Well, there is a point. As I say, though, even in the case of civil marriage, lechatchila, we would want to get. But in case of aguna, that might be a consideration. Again, I don't want to opine on that directly, because although it is true that this would be a partial resolution for certain cases of aguna, but the bigger question is, what is the overall message that is being sent? And you have to understand that there's a balance here between private tikkunim that will benefit discrete individuals and a societal message of what type of world you want to have. I'll give you another example, totally unrelated, but there's an analogy. And that is, let's say you have a man and a woman who are living together without marriage, without kedushin at all. If I'm a rabbi, should I encourage the woman to go to the mikveh every month? Because on one hand, even if they're single, the issur of nida is very, very chamor, and at least we could minimize the aveira. Right? So if I'm just looking at them as individuals, I should very definitely tell them to go to the mikveh, because that way we're taking away the issur of nida, which is very, very chamor. On the other hand, to have a public policy that says the mikveh is open to unmarried couples who want to use it is kind of giving a hechsher or giving a legitimacy for premarital relationships. So there's a very difficult balance that communities have to decide between how do I help an individual live a more religious life versus what type of message am I sending to a kehila as a whole. I think civil marriage is a similar type of problem in that area. Yeah. So let me go through a few. I will address this issue, although not fully. And again, I want to point out a very important point that sometimes the press is not sensitive to. The mere fact that something is numerically small doesn't mean that it's incorrect. Meaning there are halachic grounds, and sometimes the halachic grounds may not exist. So we can't blithely assume that there's something wrong with the system. Although, as I say, it is small and...
It's
increased a little bit. The truth of the matter is, some of this involves exposure to the realities of family life. Meaning, the yonim might come from a certain segment of the community, they may not be fully aware always of family dynamics. And I know the National Conference of the Israel and some other groups are trying to raise the fact, even without getting into feminist issues, even the introduction of the tyrannies into the system is actually improving it on that particular level. Not so much with halachas, because Dayan and Baruch Hashem know halachas very, very well, and they don't necessarily need help in halachic determinations. But in the family dynamics situation of what is abusive behavior and the like, there sometimes needs to be a little bit of education.
Yeah. Do you have any statistics on how many of these get to the Beit Din, or 99% just a couple agrees and
you're correct. As you say, Aguna is not a large number, and most of the time they don't have to go. Well, I mean, you may have to open a tick for Mizonot and other things, but most of the time, you know, a get could be given without going through a whole Beit Din procedure. It's certainly a majority. I would say around at least 75%, maybe 80%, maybe 90% even. It's very, very high. I mean, most of the time, husband and wife come to a sad conclusion that we have to separate, and they do it. You know, not everything is a problem. We focus on the hard cases, but not every case is such a hard. It's all sad, but it's not always hard. Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
But
actually, reverse case. Wanted a divorce, but she didn't want to get divorced until she got the opposite amount of money.
Yes.
And then they settled finally.
Yeah, it is true. It is 100% true that a man can be an agun as well, at least for among Ashkenazim. And that is because, although under Torah law, a man can have two wives. So if a woman refuses to take a get, I can just marry somebody else. But since the Takana of Rabbeinu Gershom, a man cannot divorce a woman against her will, nor can a man take another wife. So essentially, she could say, I'm not taking the gets until you give me whatever I want. So the man can be an agun, but the man does not have quite the same problem as the woman. Number one, if the man enters a marriage or a relationship, he will not produce mamzer. That's one thing. And number two, the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom, in theory at least, can be lifted by 100 rabbanim. So theoretically, the man might get a heter by putting the get in escrow. A woman could not get such a heter. Now, yeah.
Do you want to address at all the American prenup agreement?
Yes.
To some extent.
That's correct. That's correct. So let me address what people are doing. Prenuptial agreements, Hashem. And both in the United States and in Israel, other countries as well. Let me start with the American agreement. The American agreement is, there are many agreements, but the one that's most commonly used is the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America. And the point is, the RCA agreement is actually three agreements in one, three agreements that are combined. And in theory, you can do one without the other, but they recommend all three. The first agreement is simply an agreement to submit your disputes to a Beis Din, and their Beis Din is called Beis Din of America. Now, what does that do? That simply says, legally, I've entered into an arbitration agreement to go to a Beis Din and abide by their decision. What is the mila of that? Because arbitration agreements are enforceable by going to court. So if the husband refuses to go to the Beis Din, or the husband refuses to obey the Beis Din, this will give the woman the power to go to secular court halachically, and the secular court will order the husband, through fines and the like, to comply. Now, it means, although I said in the beginning of our remarks that a secular court will not force a person to listen to a Beis Din, that's only in the absence of an arbitration agreement. Once there's an arbitration agreement, they will force. And the courts have said that is not a violation of separation of church and state. That's simply forcing you to go to arbitration and listen to the arbitrator. Now, that part of the agreement is essentially unnecessary in Eretz Israel. Because in Eretz Israel, legally, you already have to go to the Beis Din and listen to the Beis Din. So part A is very, very useful in the United States. That part is not nogeya Eretz Yisrael, because there's already a legal obligation to go to the basin. Now, one thing. Part A is only going to help you, though, if the woman gets an order, ordering the man to give the get. Meaning, it's a way of getting the man to go to the basin and listening to the basin. But if you're not going to get that order, it gives the woman no help. Now, Part B is a separate thing. Part B, which is nogeya Eretz Yisrael as well, is essentially an indirect way to encourage a man to give a get if the woman cannot live with him anymore. It's a way of getting the Rambam in an indirect mechanism. And that is creating a support obligation. We know that one of the duties of a husband is obligated to support his wife. You know, food, lodging, clothing. This is an obligation of the ksuba. According to many opinions, it is a doraisa obligation. In fact, the whole idea that a woman works and supports the home for koldo, as noble as that is, one has to understand that that is totally optional, in the sense that a woman has the right to demand that her husband support her. Now, normally, support is not quantified. We don't tell the husband, well, you have to give X amount of dollars. But in theory, the husband could obligate himself, hitchayvut, to quantify what is mizonot. Now, mizonot exists until he gives a get. So, if a person signs an agreement that says, for every week that we are halachically married, but we are not living under the same roof, you will have to pay me $250, $300, $500, $1,000. So you're not penalizing. If you were to say like this, wording is very important. If you were to say, as punishment for not giving me a get, you have to pay me $1,000 a week, that would be a get, that would be a compelled get, that would be punishment. But this is not structured as a knas or a punishment. This is simply the quantification of mizonot. So the husband has an incentive to give a get because he wants to terminate this bill that keeps on growing. Now, the advantage of a mizonot obligation that's quantified is it creates an incentive that encourages the man to give a get when she feels the marriage is intolerable, without the need to get a psak based in that he's chayav to give a get, because it works by itself. Now, I want to point out, number one, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg has advocated this type of mizonot agreement, even in Eretz Yisrael, and many people do it. And number two, I want to say that the Bat Dei Din have sometimes done this on their own without an agreement, meaning, this goes back to it, even if a Beis Din is unwilling to order a man to give a get, what a Beis Din might say is this: we will not order you to give a get, but we will order you to pay mizonot at the rate of $1,000 a week or whatever it is. And that's an indirect way of getting a man to give a get. So the Bat Dei Din have done that on their own, and Rav Zalman Nechemia encourages a hesken to quantify it, and that is Part B of the RCA agreement as well. The danger is this. The danger is that this may not work for a lot of people. Because if the husband is poor, he's not going to pay it anyway, he doesn't have the money. So good, I owe, you know, my money keeps on increasing, I don't have the money. If I'm very rich and I want to hurt my wife, I'll pay the money. So it may only work for the middle of the road person who has the money, but it would be a big hardship for them as well. Another issue is that if the amount of money is too high, if it's too low, it's not an incentive. If it's too high, it may be interpreted as a disguised penalty for not giving a get, which would make it a get melissa. It has to be in the range of what is called reasonable mizonot, but it has to be high enough that it has a certain kibbutz. And the advantage is this would eliminate the need of the Beis Din finding grounds for a chiyuv. That is Part B of the RCA agreement. There is a Part C, which is not about aguna at all. It simply indicates that on matters of property and the like, the parties are given a choice. Do they want the Beis Din to decide property based on halachic rules or based on dina de malchusa dina? Because halacha does allow the parties in monetary matters to choose. So that's a matter of property rights. Again, in Eretz Yisrael, a similar choice actually has to be made, because in that, although the Rabbanut has exclusive power over the termination of a marriage, with respect to property divisions, there actually is a choice if you want it to be Israeli Knesset law or Eben Ha'ezer. So the RCA has in their Hesken, they have the ability to choose that. Yeah.
The court ordered the settlement. Everything was settled with the he had to give her a court ordered settlement.
Yeah.
He gave it to her, but now he's using. He's a very wealthy man. He's using the Yerusha that he would leave the children that they had as a ploy or a vehicle or whatever. So he's threatening her that if he doesn't give back the court ordered settlement, he's not leaving their kids any Yerusha. Blackmail, yeah, blackmail's a good word. But I still haven't figured out. I've got some prenup agreement.
Yes, I don't know what prenup would fully address
that. The truth of the matter is that could be taken care of if estate planning were done while they were still married.
Yeah, so you could have created a trust for the children that cannot be invaded, but that would have to be done when they're still.
Right, they're both parties.
Well, I guess in a prenup they could do it. Yeah, when things are still good, they could arrange for something like that.
When they're still doing a prenup, when they're doing a prenup, the eventuality of a possible divorce.
That's right. What you do. Yeah, yeah.
It didn't work. The mason actually slagged the prenup.
Well, again, I don't know the specifics.
The situation was that I think they did the prenup through the baker's spot.
Okay.
And then they came back again and went through. And Baker Smart monitored it.
Yeah.
And then they came back to the base then, and then the base then
slide. Yeah, well, what can I tell you? You know, this is not for amateurs, and you need to. Especially in a system like Israel, where you have multiple courts that operate with different rules, but they're both arms of the state. It's going to be very. You got to be sure that you're working within both coordinates. It's not.
Or work with one.
That's right.
Yeah. You might be interested in knowing South Africa is law. It's been put into law.
Yes.
When you get a civil divorce, you have to give a get.
You will not
get your civil divorce without giving the get.
Right.
And the second thing that if you don't pay maintenance, and if you won't give the get, you're putting to pay.
Yeah. Very good. Well, I'll put it higher than that you can even do in America. But let me point out that the South African law is actually based on New York, so I want to give credit to the old, good old USA. And that is, New York has two laws, the only state in the United States, has two laws about gittin. There's get law number one, which is from 1983, and get law number two, which is 1993. Get law number one, put in simple English, I don't want to go over all the complications. Get law number one had the Haskama of Rav Moshe Feinstein, because he was still alive then. And that basically says, no man can get a civil divorce. Actually, no person can get a civil divorce unless they have removed any barriers to the marriage of the other spouse. So it doesn't say get, because obviously you don't want to mention in any law something overtly. Okay, that's unusual. But in America, they can't say get. But they talk about, you, if I'm a husband, I will not get a civil divorce in the state of New York unless I file a statement under oath, and I can be prosecuted for perjury, that I have removed barriers to the impediment, barriers that impede the marriage of the other person. Now, what if I want to lie? So listen to this, very interesting. So what if I file the affidavit and I didn't give the get? So it says the rabbi, who is Masader Kedushin, files a counter affidavit that no get was given, and I will not get a divorce until that same rabbi files a counter affidavit that a get was given. That way, the judge doesn't decide whether it's a kosher get, it's the Messiah Kedusha. Now, again, there are some kinks in this system. What if that rabbi dies? Maybe, I'll never, he files the first affidavit that says no get was given, then he dies, and according to the literal wording of the law, I have no way of ever getting a civil divorce, because only that rabbi can count. Yeah, there's some kinks that have to be worked out.
Yeah. In the state of New York, the Messiah Kedusha is obligated, after doing the Seder Kedusha, to file with the court the Seder Kedusha.
Right.
Now, I've had cases where either the rabbi neglects to, or purposely doesn't do it because the couple doesn't want what
right.
they think they don't want a civil
right.
marriage, they only want a religious marriage.
Right.
Know that under the statute, forget the statute number, in New York, a religious marriage is equivalent to a civil marriage.
Yep.
And if the marriage is going to, if a man is trying to say, well, I'm not giving her, I'm really not married civilly.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could fight it, because religious marriage is considered as a civil marriage in the state of New York.
Yeah, that's right. I understand that in the state of New York, if a rabbi were to conduct a religious marriage without a marriage license, that would be a criminal, a misdemeanor. Would have to be against the law because it is treated as a marriage without a license.
A lot of them don't file.
Yeah, I understand. But let me just mention the two laws. So law number one is you don't get a man cannot get a civil divorce unless he removes the barriers to the remarriage of the spouse. Meaning, you ever get or you get no civil divorce. Your Moshe Feinstein said that's fine. Now, get law number two, which was passed after Rabbi Moshe was Nifter, is much more controversial. That says that when a court divides up property and determines maintenance and supports, the court may consider as a negative factor any maintenance of a barrier to remarriage. Practically putting that in simple English, in the state of New York, a judge in the state of New York can tell a man, if you give a get, we'll give you 50% of your house. If you don't give a get, you lose it all. If you give a get, your alimony will be $500 a week. If you don't give a get, $1,000. Now, this is better because it doesn't just deny a civil divorce. It actually says you'll lose property. But here's the thing. This is called New York Get Law Number 2. New York Get Law Number 2 is enormously controversial halachically because great Gedolei HaPoskim, Rabbi Yoshef, he actually said, and many rabbis in the United States actually said, for a secular court to tell a man, you give a get or you lose your house, when a Beis Din hasn't ordered him to give the get, is a classic case of get ma'usa. And the get that is given pursuant to that order would be an invalid get. Bishlama, get law number one, is not ma'usa, because that's a denial of benefit, because it's just preserving the status quo. You're married. You want a new benefit called divorce. We're not going to give you the new benefit till you give a get. Rav Moshe says, that is called meniat harevach. That is called a denial of benefit. That's not called mu'useh. But to take away something he already owns, or to impose a higher alimony, Rav Yashiv said, that is coercion. So it's very, very interesting that there are poskim who say that any get that a man gave because an order was issued against him under New York Get Law Number 2, the get is actually possible. Big machlokas. The RCA, as a rabbinical organization, has taken the position that the Get Law Number 2 is perfectly valid. But I have to say, as a matter of psak halacha, the RCA has no stand. I mean, it's just a vote. I mean, what are you going to say? I mean, whatever. Not every member of the RCA is a great poskim, and in fact, the great poskim of the RCA rejects Get Law Number 2. So if it's simply a matter of individual rabbis taking a vote, it's not anything you could be samach on. So I'm not giving you a psak, but Get Law Number 2 is very risky. But the New York Get Laws have been the prototype of South Africa. Ontario in Canada, provincially, has a similar law, and England, United Kingdom, has a similar one, all based on New York Get Law, and the guiding light of the first New York Get Laws by a very good friend and colleague, Nathan Lewin, a very prominent attorney in the Washington area who often comes to Eretz Yisrael as well. Yeah.
Okay,
don't really want to be controversial, but one of my co-gender mates in the back quoted Boo Greenberg, who said, when there's a rabbinic way, will there's a rabbinic way. And we could belabor all of the examples in which rabbis have found ways to solve problems for men.
Yeah.
Where's the rabbinic will in this particular case? It's great to talk about Nat Lewin, and it's great to talk about all of the advocates who have worked through the secular legal system.
Yeah.
This is a problem.
It is a problem, although it's not as numerically as large as people make. But it is a problem. Even if one woman is suffering, it is a problem, 100%. And, you know, the statement, although I respect what Blue Greenberg is coming from, but the statement, when there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way, or whatever, it's frankly not entirely true. I mean, it is an oversimplification. There are sometimes limits that we are confronted with.
Kohanim, who declare they're no longer Kohanim in order to marry someone.
But there are rules.
But you know that happens.
But there are rules for that. Meaning, it's not resigning. You resign your kahuna. But let me mention one example of what you might consider to be a very, very interesting expansion of this. Last year, Kindness Esther. You know, we've been talking about all sorts of things. We put people in chayrim, we can beat them, we can put them in prison, we can have prenuptial agreements. But there's one case in which halakha had virtually no solution at all that was even possible. And that is, instead of the recalcitrant husband, what about the incapacitated husband? The person in a coma. The person who is not competent to give again. There was really absolutely nothing that could be done for that, because all of your prenuptial agreements aren't going to work if the person is not able to give a gap. So, last year, there was a Beit Din in Tzfat, and the woman happened to be Chiloni, but that makes no difference. She petitioned the Beit Din. Her husband had been in a coma for 6.5 years. There's always a chance, but the doctors had thought there was no reasonable possibility that he would either come out of the coma, nor was there a strong probability he would die very, very soon. He might be in that state for many, many years. And the Beit Din in Tzfat, which was a very reputable Beit Din, issued a 95-page opinion, which for a Beit Din is very, very unusual. The typical Beit Din decision might be 2 pages. And they authorized themselves to give a get on behalf of the husband. Let me explain what they did, and let me explain why many people have not accepted it. It's very, very controversial. They said the following. Normally, when a man gives a get, a man could give the get himself, or the man could make a shaliach. That's very common. The man is in a different country. In fact, you can have a shaliach of the man give the get to a shaliach of the woman. They don't have to see each other, as it were. Okay, so shalucho shaladam kamosa. Now, we have another principle that applies called Zachin li Adam Shelo Bafanav. That means the following. Let's take business transactions. If I find a diamond in the street and I pick it up with the intention that I'm acquiring it for you, even though you didn't make me your shaliach, since I know for sure that this would be something that you would approve of, I can confer a benefit on you without your knowledge, meaning I can self-appoint myself as a shaliach when it's a benefit to you and you would certainly want that result. Right? So there is shaliach, which is I make you a shaliach, and then there is zachin li adam shelo b'fanav, I can be your shaliach without your consent, as long as you don't object, of course, if it's a benefit. So the Beit Din of Tzfat ruled in the following way. Although the husband in the coma never made a shaliach to give a get, and as a result there is no official shaliach that can give a get, but we can assume, this is what I'm just quoting the Beit Din, I'm not giving you my opinion, we can assume that if the husband would have a moment of consciousness, let's say he could open his eyes for 5 seconds, or 10 seconds, a minute, he certainly would not want to put his wife through pain and suffering. So for us to be his shaliach can fit under the rubric of zachin li adam shelo b'fanav, And we can be his shaliach to give a get to his wife, because we can assume that this is certainly what he would have desired. Now, let me point out, the Beit Din in Sfat put into a footnote a very important rule that some people are already ignoring, and that is, this only works for the comatose husband. This does not work for the recalcitrant husband. In other words, the husband who says, I don't want to give a get, you certainly can't use Zachim Le'adam Shel B'fanav to be his shaliach. But when you don't know, you make an assumption. Okay. Now, this is one of the most controversial psukim that has existed, really almost over the past 20 years. Enormously controversial. Most of the Gedolim have not, although this was not a superficial group of people. These Dayanim were very, very capable people. They were Lamdanim and Talmidei Chachamim. They weren't simply making up rules. But still, their psak is enormously controversial. Let me just explain why. I just want to give you why there's a problem. I mean, why isn't this self-evident? The reason why it's not self-evident is the following reason. Zachim Le'adam Shelo B'fanav is essentially a surrogate shaliach, that since we know for sure that you would have been willing to authorize this because it's a benefit, so I can be your shaliach without your authorization. But according to this, the tzvichia can be no better than a real shaliach. And the halacha is that once a person is incompetent, a shaliach cannot act for him. Meaning, let's say he made a shaliach. Halachically, if he would have made a shaliach and then gone into a coma, the shaliach could not deliver the get. Because shalichas can apply only as an extension of the mishaleach who's legally, halachically competent. Once you're not halachically competent, the shalichas becomes nullified and terminated.
That, it's not durable, it's not a durable power.
That's correct. That is correct. Shalichas for gittin, at least, not for money. Shalichas for gittin are not durable powers of attorney. And if a shalichas is not a durable power of attorney, zachiyah, which is only presumptive shalichas, cannot be better than real shalichas. It is a big problem, but I just want to say that this is an example of a Beis Din trying, very, very difficult to find halachic reasons. But you understand the problem, and part of the problem is, you know, you help the woman, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. You help the woman, but let's say she has children from a second marriage and some other Beis Din disagrees with all this reasoning. You might be creating people who will be stigmatized as mamzerim down the road, which means, just as a practical matter, without even addressing the merits of all this, you have to understand you can't have individual small groups making these decisions that are not accepted by other groups, because children are going to be labeled and stigmatized. For example, there was a Beis Din in New York that was founded by the late Rabbi Rachman Olav Shalom. He was a very prominent American rabbi who became the chancellor of Bar Ilan. And again, Rabbi Rachman is number one, was a very talented person and a very person who really had a lot of Avot Yisrael, and a person who greatly felt the pain of Abunot. So he created a system in which many marriages were simply annulled by finding them to be Kedushei Ta'ut. Kedushei Ta'ut means marriages that were made by mistake, by misrepresentation or mistake. Now, the principle that a marriage can be annulled because of Ta'ut is a very well-known principle. The Mishnah gives a million cases. A man marries a woman saying he's a Kohen, and she discovers he's not a Kohen. You don't need a get, right? Kedushei Ta'ut. Rav Moshe has a tshuva. A woman marries a man and discovers he's gay. You don't need a get, because she never would have agreed to such a thing. This is well known. But, generally speaking, here's the knetch. In order to be a ta'ut, there has to be some undisclosed factor that was in existence at the time of the marriage. So if a woman discovers after she's married that this man had a history of abuse, that might be ta'ut. But if he became an abuser later, she could demand a get, but she could not say ta'ut because there was no ta'ut at the time. Now, what Rabbi Rachman's based in did is, they kind of took a psychological judgment and said, hey, if he did it later, he must have had it in him from the very beginning. So essentially, they basically took every bad behavior down the road and turned it into a pre-existing condition which was Negev Talith. And I think over 200 women were given heterim based on this. And this, again, I'm not questioning anybody's motives, but this is extraordinarily dangerous, because if you take that logic to its extreme, then no woman ever needs a get, because obviously if she wants a get, there's a problem. Every time there's a problem. I wouldn't have married a guy with those problems. Right? So you have to be, in other words, any logic that basically says you never have to give a get can't be correct, because the Torah says there's such a thing as get. So that would be an example of a very, very dangerous procedure. And I know Poskim would say the children that are born from those peturim, those heterim, are going to be mamzerim. And the Tzfat, based on, although it's only a single woman, they got such a heter, I don't know if she's planning on having children, but I think there may be a similar type of problem. But I just wanted to share with you this very, very interesting Tzfat. There have been people, Jaffa, the Jewish Orthodox feminist, that have been talking about get sikui for a long time, but frankly, we didn't pay attention because they had a political agenda. But the space and Tzfat, as I say, are very, very chashuv talmidei chachamim, and they did make a 95-page case for this. So it's something that we do have to pay attention to. But again, as I say, although it does address the very, very serious problem of the incapacitated husband, it is not a solution for the recalcitrant husband. And already the Jerusalem Post and other even some rabbis are distorting this psak based in by looking at it as the basis of every problem of agunah. We can resolve by what is called a get zikoi. And it's absolutely not the case. It only helps in a small group of cases, where you have an incapacitated husband. Yeah.
The heter may or rabban.
Yeah.
So if a man's wife is incapacitated,
yes,
and he can go to 100 rabban and
yes,
prove it, and he
yes,
can remarry.
That's correct.
But the same thing with a woman doesn't apply.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's where man and woman are different. The man can be given a heter may or rabban for an incapacitated wife on the condition that he continued to support the incapacitated wife and provide for her medical care. He does not divorce her. He is given the heter to have a second wife, but he has all of his obligations of support towards the first wife are still present. A woman doesn't have that option, and that's where the get zikui idea comes in. So again, there's a lot more to talk about. As just a shem, I just want to end with one little point, and that is, the motto, at least the Americans know this, the motto of the National Rifle Association, they say guns don't kill people, people kill people, but some people say people with guns kill people, in many, many ways, we have to understand that the aguna problem, not at least in the case of the recalcitrant husband, is ultimately a problem in menschlichkeit, in derech eretz, in human relationships. Meaning to say, with all of your prenups and all of your piskei din and everything else, there's only up to a certain level you can go. And if in our chinuch we don't raise people to be menschlich, to be considerate, to understand that even if Rahman al-Sani marriage has to dissolve, it can still be done with derech eretz and with courtesy and with respect. If that lesson is not conveyed, then all of the halachic niceties that you can come up with are not going to solve the problem. So really, we have to start emphasizing, some people try to do it already, but we have to build into our achinuch systems the notion of how one treats another human being and how one treats a wife, how a wife treats a husband. There was a survey in New York a few years ago about high school kids in yeshivas. They were asked, what do they think a marriage is about? And they, why do you want to get married? And so they said, well, I want somebody to cook for me, I want somebody to clean for me, I want basically the concept was, I want to have my life, do what I want, but then come home and have a clean house and three meals. And when you have that attitude of selfishness, then you're going to get, agunah cases. I didn't get what I want, I'm going to hold back a get, and this and that. So ultimately, if we work on our midos, we work on our character, we work on becoming better people, then memela, a lot of these cases are going to disappear. So, Be'ez Hashem, we should be better.